Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, we'll share with you excerpts of a recent speech from author, journalist, and historian David Talbot. He recently spoke at Social Justice Week at Sonoma State University in Northern California, and he talked about his latest book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from author, journalist, and historian David Talbot. Talbot is author of the New York Times bestseller Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and the acclaimed national bestseller Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. He's founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon, former senior editor at Mother Jones, was also a features editor at San Francisco Examiner. He's written for The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, Time, and The Guardian. And his latest book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government, was the subject of the speech that he gave March 21st at Sonoma State University. I was host and MC for the evening, and now we share excerpts of David Talbot's talk with you.
We live in a lawless age. And I'm not speaking here of crime in the street, but crime in the suites. Top Washington officials, from the president on down, order remote-controlled assassinations with the barest fig leaf of legal review. Are these human targets guilty or innocent? We'll never know. These decisions to spare or take human life, including the lives sometimes of American citizens, are conducted in star chamber-like secrecy. Since 9/11, our leaders have been playing God, ordering assassinations at will, torture, mind control experimentation, massive snooping on private citizens and foreign officials all over the globe, suspending our civil liberties, and expanding the war on terror wherever and whenever our all-powerful national security state decides it must intrude. Meanwhile, as Washington extends its ominous shadow into every corner of the world and every corner of our lives, Wall Street continues to amass wealth and impoverish the rest of the nation in a frenzy of looting with virtually no government oversight. Since, as Senator Bernie Sanders has repeatedly pointed out, Wall Street owns Washington. Recently, a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Afghanistan was subjected to withering U.S.-led bombardment for nearly an hour, despite the frantic pleas that the medical staff at the hospital communicated to their American military contacts throughout this terrible ordeal. This fiery assault, which took the lives of doctors, nurses, and patients, was clearly intentional, as Doctors Without Borders later charged. The hospital's crime? Treating wounded Taliban fighters, as required under international law. Doctors Without Borders called the hospital bombing a war crime, which it certainly was, and demanded an independent investigation. But in a pattern that is all too familiar, the Pentagon simply expressed its regrets, promised to conduct its own internal inquiry, and there the matter will certainly languish until a bland official statement is released sometime in the future, informing us that a mid-level military fall guy has been reprimanded and the case closed. When it comes to the top lawbreakers in our country, there is no law. There is no public accountability. No truth, no consequences. And when those at the top escape justice, when there is no rule of law, there can be no social justice. Nobody has been prosecuted for the torture and murder of prisoners at so-called CIA black sites during the Bush-Cheney administration. In fact, the only CIA officer who went to prison, the hero John Kiriakou, was punished for blowing the whistle on waterboarding. President Obama came into office criticizing the excesses of Bush's war on terror. But no sooner did he move into the Oval Office did he tell the American people that we must look forward, not back. And so, with no public reckoning for the Bush era, the Obama administration was free to commit its own violations of international law and human rights, vastly expanding the government's drone-killing program, its Orwellian surveillance system, and its war on whistleblowers like Ed Snowden. a young man whose inspiring heroism is one of the few bright lights of our dark age. It's the age of terror. A word, as Glenn Greenwald points out, that means nothing and yet excuses everything, including our government's own widespread terror, which dwarfs that of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And of course, while Washington engages in criminal mayhem all over the world, not one of the Wall Street banksters responsible for the great crash 2008, from which our economy has yet to fully recover, has seen the inside of a courtroom, let alone a jail. And the tax and credit and labor policies that the criminal masterminds of Wall Street advocate and implement through their hired servants in Washington continue to shift wealth to the upper percentile of America. As this rampant violence and corruption at the top levels of our nation goes unpunished year after year, a deep rot begins to eat away at our national psyche. President Obama harshly scolds Donald Trump for his reckless and morally unhinged public remark about scapegoating Muslims, taking the leash off torturers, and killing civilians. But it's the endless and illegal war on terror, half of which has been presided over by Obama himself, that has paved the way for Trump's lunatic militarism, authoritarianism, and anti-Muslim fear-mongering. In our age of lawlessness, when no high official is held accountable, then anything is possible. Trump is just the product of America's unbridled id, a creature who has crawled from our moral swamp. And so, as we celebrate social justice this week on the Sonoma State campus, what must we ask of our fellow citizens if we are to arrest our nation's moral decline? First, we must urge Americans to know their history. We Americans, as most of us know here, suffer from amnesia when it comes to our national past. All that most of us know about our history comes from heavily censored school textbooks and the patriotic propaganda spewed out by cable TV news and by Hollywood. Films and TV shows like American Sniper, Zero Dark Thirty, Homeland, and so on and so on. Spectacles of spin that would make Joseph Goebbels proud. This constant barrage of American triumphalism not only manufactures consent, to use Noam Chomsky's phrase, it manufactures ignorance. A dumbing down of the American citizenry that ironically seems to be only getting worse in the digital age, which was supposed to liberate all of our minds. We all must learn about how oligarchy came to defeat and replace democracy in America. We need to go much deeper than Bernie's soundbites, as important and provocative as they are. As I write in my new book, The Devil's Chessboard, many of the darkest deeds of what some call our deep state or secret government began not simply after 9/11, but decades ago during the Cold War. At the center of this subversion of American democracy was a group of powerful Wall Street and national security figures like the Dulles brothers, men, and they were almost exclusively men, whom the brilliant sociologist C. Wright Mills called, quote, the power elite. Men like Alan Dulles, who shuttled between Wall Street and the shadowy intelligence world in Washington his whole career. They believed that democracy was too important to be left in the hands of people like you and me or our elected representatives. During Dulles's one foray into the Democratic arena when he ran for Congress from the Upper East Side of Manhattan in 1938, he actually told the press that, quote, democracy only works if the so-called intelligent people run it. For some reason, the electorate didn't send him to Congress. Of course, the intelligent people that Dulles had in mind were himself, his brother, and law partner, John Foster Dulles, who would rise to become Secretary of State and give his name to Washington's International Airport, and the Dulles brothers' circle of wealthy and powerful business clients and political collaborators. You know, we Americans like to think of ourselves as a classless and democratic society, but of course we're not. We're as dynastic and oligarchic as the Game of Thrones. And our kings and lords are just as brutal when it comes to grabbing power or maintaining their power. During his long reign at the center of America's secret government, those men who continue to wield power in one presidency after the next, no matter who happens to occupy the White House, and often in defiance of the president, Alan Dulles committed every sort of crime to enforce American interests around the world. And of course, by American interests, he really meant the interest of his corporate clients. As the force behind the creation of the CIA and as the agency's longest-serving director, Dulles overthrew democratic governments around the world, he assassinated foreign leaders, he tortured people, he created a massive mind control program codenamed MKUltra, he opened private citizens' mail, he tapped their phones. In other words, Dick Cheney was only following in the giant steps of men like Alan Dulles. Today, the lobby of the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, is still graced by a sculpture of Dulles, a man who looked more like a genial, pipe-smoking British headmaster than the cold-blooded executioner, although that is precisely what he was. His monument is around us, reads the inscription beneath the sculpture. The words sound like a curse on the men and women who work at the CIA, our citadel of national security, and on all those, including us, whom they serve. When men like Alan Dulles are given license or take the liberty of doing whatever they want to enforce America's imperial will around the world, it is, of course, only a matter of time before they are emboldened to do the same thing here at home. President Harry Truman, who signed the CIA into existence back in 1947, later came to realize that he had indeed created a monster, one that was capable not only of sabotaging democracies overseas and killing elected leaders overseas, but also at home. Truman wrote a remarkable op-ed article for the Washington Post in December 1963, just weeks after the assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas. To some observers during those emotionally fraught days after JFK's murder, the timing of Truman's bombshell of an essay, which attacked the CIA as a growing threat to democracy at home and abroad, was deeply disturbing. Was Truman suggesting that the CIA was in some way involved with the killing of President Kennedy, who had clashed bitterly with Alan Dulles throughout his administration, over JFK's efforts to reduce Cold War tensions with Russia and Cuba? I will let those of you who are tempted to read my new book come to your own conclusions about Dulles and Kennedy's fate. As power generally does in cases of national traumas like the Kennedy assassination, the so-called intelligent men like Dulles move swiftly to cover up the crime rather than to investigate it. Dulles, Kennedy's bitter enemy, got himself conveniently appointed to the Warren Commission, the distinguished group of power players assigned to solve the crime. The panel, under Dulles' firm direction, soon came to its foreordained conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald, the young high school dropout and mediocre marksman and self-described patsy, had pulled off the rifle shot and the crime of the century. And since Oswald himself had already been promptly eliminated to spare the nation the trouble of a real trial, he was not there to dispute the Warren Commission's neat conclusion. Case closed. Go back to sleep, America. But Americans, to their credit, were restless and troubled in their sleep. Poll after poll over the last half century has demonstrated that most of us don't buy the official story of the Kennedy assassination. For many people in my generation, this was the beginning of questioning authority, which is to say the stirrings of a democratic consciousness. Today, all of us must continue to encourage to push for this growing skepticism about power, particularly when it comes to official lies and the cover-up of crimes. And if our leaders refuse to hold those in Washington and Wall Street responsible for their lawbreaking, then we must begin to do it. Next month, my new publishing imprint, which is called Hot Books, will publish a provocative new book called American Nuremberg. The subtitle is The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. It's by a very good author, Rebecca Gordon, who was a human rights activist in Central America during the Reagan Wars there, and is now a philosophy professor at the University of San Francisco. As Gordon acknowledges in her book, given the current political realities, we cannot expect Congress or the courts to hold the men responsible for the vast criminality of the war on terror, from Presidents Bush and Obama on down. So, inspired by such examples as the Independent War Crimes Tribunal that was organized by the philosophers Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre during the Vietnam War, a similarly distinguished group of legal scholars and human rights experts must come together to hold a trial for Bush, Obama, Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, CIA directors George Tenet, Michael Hayden, and John Brennan, military commanders David Petraeus and Stanley McChrystal, and the top government lawyers and psychologists and other functionaries who are primarily responsible for the war crimes of the past 15 years. Gordon writes, quote, "There is a pressing need to bring the United States into the legal community of nations where it must be held accountable for its actions. If the most powerful country in the world," she writes, "can violate international law and human rights with complete impunity, then why should any other nation be constrained? For the sake of the victims of the war on terror, for the sake of our own national soul, but even more for the future of humanity, we need a full accounting for American war criminals. We need an American Nuremberg," end quote. And so let us begin this week that's dedicated to social justice by beginning to examine how we ourselves can restore the rule of law in our own country by holding those high officials responsible for crimes committed in our name. Justice is never perfect, not even at Nuremberg in post-war Germany, which still stands as a shining symbol of international law. Thanks to men like Alan Dulles, many high-ranking Nazis were actually allowed to escape justice. And of course, the Allies did not hold themselves accountable for their own war crimes. The firebombing of Tokyo and Dresden, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But nonetheless, here today, we can begin to take the first steps in defiance of the official lawlessness of our own age, of this age of terror. We can start the slow wheels of justice by identifying the lawbreakers and their crimes, and we can make clear that these crimes are not being committed in our names. Not in our names. That must become our slogan. We are not good Germans. Someday, even if all of us are not there to witness it, justice will prevail. Thank you very much. Are you going to take questions? Yeah.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. We just heard a speech delivered by journalist, author, and historian David Talbot at Sonoma State University in Northern California on March 21st as part of Social Justice Week. Following the speech was a long question and answer period with the audience. We'll play part of that after this musical break. Stay with us.
Child is being born deformed. And I saw that. I went back there in 1992. I went to see my friend, an ethnic Chinese in Xiaolan. And he took me out to an old ramshackle clinic. And it was a horror story. There were kids much worse than his son. His son had no eyes. But his son was lucky because some of them had no brains. And some of them, their parts of their body were outside. And what are we, as Americans, doing for these children, born long after we left, long after we left? Yeah, what are we doing for them?
Yeah, well,
that's where the priority lies.
I think that's a very important question. So the gentleman is a veteran of World War II, and he has gone to Vietnam and had occasion to see some of the terrible deformities that children are being born there. I suspect because of Agent Orange. It's that Agent Orange, which of course was the herbicide that was sprayed randomly all over Vietnam to destroy the foliage so we could have better targets. Pardon me?
Approved by Monsanto.
Dow Chemical. Yes.
Now they're going to combine it with glycophosphate Roundup right around here.
To me, what this suggests is, again, yes, these were war crimes that were committed against the people of Vietnam that continue to have these terrible effects that never were punished, that the people responsible for this at Dow Chemical or the Pentagon were never brought to justice. And in fact, of course, every war has these terrible environmental and health problems, disasters that continue to ripple decade after decade. Right now, we're creating a new Agent Orange calamity in Iraq and Afghanistan through the operation of these open-air burn pits. Do people know about the burn pits? The burn pits are these huge waste dumps that were built by, guess who? Dick Cheney's company, Halliburton KBR, made a fortune off them. And they burn everything in them, at every military base in Iraq and Afghanistan. Plastics, metals, medical waste, old munitions, human body parts. And our soldiers are forced to breathe this junk 24/7. In some cases, the air is so polluted that the soldiers desperately, in their barracks, put towels up against the ventilation so the air can't come in. And in the morning, they told one journalist who has written a book for me, military whistleblower, former Marine and Army veteran named Joe Hickman, that these white towels were black by the morning time when they woke up. Among the victims, we believe, of the burn pits was Bo Biden, Joe Biden's son, who served at two of the worst bases where the worst pollution was, including Balad in Iraq. And he came back home, of course, with a rare brain cancer. There's clusters of rare brain cancers, of terrible respiratory disease. Thousands of soldiers are coming home with this, as well as the people of Iraq and Afghanistan who live downwind from this terrible pollution. So again, every war has these hidden costs that the American people are not told about. And the people who bear the brunt of those costs, of course, are our own soldiers, who we always say we honor their service, but until they come home and we throw them away like waste. And we don't take care of them. And the people, of course, that we devastate in these countries where we go to war. Yes?
I was the refugee advisor for USAID, and USAID is part of CIA. So I know the CIA very, very well. As a refugee advisor, I saw what our soldiers, and I'm talking about not the general, not the colonel, I'm talking about our soldiers were doing to the people in Vietnam. Because I saw, because I was a refugee advisor, they were flying over and dropping napalm.
Yeah.
And burning little children that I knew personally.
Yeah. No.
But that was nothing compared to the white phosphorus. That white phosphorus just burned right into the bone.
Right. So, again, war crimes. And he's mentioning the napalm and the white phosphorus that was dropped in Vietnam on the population there. And, of course, there's the famous photo we all remember of the young girl running down the trail. And her clothes had been burned off. Her skin was, of course, terribly burned. Gentleman in the hat.
What seems like the wizard behind the screen is the industrial military complex, whether it's the assassinations or these horrific things they're talking about. So how do we go after them? Because they're the ones that are assassinating presidents. They're the ones that are assassinating leaders around the world.
Well, you're right. So the gentleman asked about the military-industrial complex, as Eisenhower, of course, termed it, just as he was conveniently leaving the White House, having helped build the military-industrial complex to enormous proportion. So I don't think of old Ike as a hero when it comes to that. He sort of turned it over to poor young Jack Kennedy, said, here you go, I built this monster, now you deal with it. But yes, that military-industrial complex now, I think, has gotten so big. In fact, our whole economy is militarized. It's not just a complex anymore. Virtually every sector, I think, of the American economy is touched in some way by this enormous war budget and surveillance budget that we've created, particularly after 9/11. I mean, the number of people who have, you know, security clearances now, the number of agencies, private companies and corporations that we don't even know about. I mean, in the old days, we could say, oh, well, it's the CIA that's in charge of snooping on people. Now it's the CIA, the NSA, the Pentagon has its own operations, the State Department, and then there's the multitude of private corporations, private contractors with whom Washington does business that we've never even heard of. So the entire nation has been militarized at this point. Sometimes out here in bucolic California and the Bay Area, it's easy to lose track of that. Although, you know, Silicon Valley has also been recruited into this war effort and plays an important role. And of course, the defense secretary, who is now Ashton Carter, routinely comes out here to pep up, you know, the Silicon Valley CEOs, telling them how much we need them. And of course, there's now this huge battle over encryption involving Apple. And, you know, the Silicon Valley does have a conscience, or at least some people in Silicon Valley have a conscience when it comes to working for the war state, the surveillance state. And certainly when Ed Snowden stood up to that surveillance state, this young, brilliant engineer who had a brilliant career ahead of him and threw it all away at the age of, what, 28 when he did this initially? That is a kind of remarkable heroism that you don't normally see, no matter what generation. And it only comes along once in a while. And his greatest fear, of course, Snowden, when he did this, he told filmmaker Laura Poitras, was that it would be met with a big collective yawn. It wouldn't make any difference. He would destroy his life for nothing. Fortunately, it did have an impact, as we all know. It made the country, at least for a while, begin to reflect on what has been done in our name. And do we want to be living 15 years after 9/11 with this big brother state, this police state, essentially, where many of our liberties have been suspended and where virtually every part of our life can be inspected by the government? So, you know, Ed Snowden is now hunkered down in Moscow. He's in exile. Julian Assange, another brave whistleblower, is in house arrest, under house arrest in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Chelsea Manning, another brave person who said, and this always chokes me up when I read this quote, to this day, this young soldier, Bradley at the time, now Chelsea, who saw these hideous videos of what we were doing to people on the ground in Iraq, these helicopter gunships blowing these innocent people apart. And he said, I just couldn't keep these things in my head anymore. And that's what it takes for a conscience to work. That's what it takes for a soldier, and there are soldiers sometimes who say to their superior officers, no. And by law, they are required to say no when they're ordered to commit a war crime. And Chelsea Manning did say that. No, I can't live with this. I can't have this in my head. I'm going to tell the world. And as a result, now, of course, she's locked away in federal penitentiary for years. But I bet she doesn't have those images or that guilt locked in her head anymore. Right here.
You talk about the banksters who haven't been imprisoned. And right here in Sonoma State, we have Sandy Weill, who Dwight Glass-Steagall, and who was one of the architects of the recession.
From Citicorp. He retired, you mean, in the wine country?
Yes. He came here, Sonoma State. Became best buddies of, thank God, now ex-president Herman Young. And now there's a hall named after him. He and his wife have spoken at economic forums. They're held up as gods of the school business.
Well, money buys everything, even universities.
The other thing I want to mention is, when you talk about deep states, I think everybody needs to look at their local governments everywhere. There's a deep state in Sonoma County.
I think that's important. You know, the old saying, think globally, act locally. And sometimes, frankly, working at the national level seems so daunting and so imposing and so impossible, given how rigged the system is. Look at poor Bernie now with the superdelegates and all that. I mean, you know, all this energy, the youthful energy that's going into that campaign, and those young people are seeing how American politics really works. But I do still believe, and some people think I'm a little naive for thinking this, but democracy can be made to work at the local and state level to some extent, if you're well organized. And in San Francisco, I'm testing my thesis right now. Yes, good for you. And I've begun to test it by joining, helping start a group called SF Vision that's fighting against the takeover of the city by the 1%, the tech elite, that is forcing people out of their homes. The evictions are skyrocketing. The homeless problem, as you know, if you've gone down to San Francisco recently, is a national disgrace. And Ed Lee, this mayor who sits in City Hall, has completely sold out the city to Twitter and Airbnb and all the other tech companies that have taken root in San Francisco. You know, he decided to just let thousands of new tech employees come into the city through tax incentives and all that without having any housing for them. So guess what? The landlords who had people who didn't make quite as much already in these homes thought, oh, I can make three or four times as much if I throw these clowns out. So thousands of people are being evicted now. I just heard of a woman in my neighborhood been trying for years to get pregnant with her husband, did get pregnant, got an eviction notice, and miscarried a few days later. I mean, so it just, the human tragedy of this is palpable right now in cities like San Francisco, where the wealth gap has exploded. At what point do Americans just say enough to that? Enough to the war state, as we were talking about earlier, but also enough to this obscene wealth gap. Bernie Sanders, no matter what happens to his campaign, is owed a huge debt of gratitude by the American people for playing the role of rabbi and you know, crusader and champion for the people. And again, reminding us of how out of whack our country has become. And we all have to just now get organized. So I'm a writer. I didn't want to leave my room, my comfortable room, you know, and get into the streets again at my age. I used to do it a lot. You know, I was younger when I was your guys' age. But I did. At 64, I decided, well, you know, for my kids, if my kids want to live in San Francisco, if they have any chance, as the young filmmakers and creative people they are, of staying in the city where they were raised, then I have to get out there and fight. And that's what we're doing. Okay, another one here. Yes.
What are you doing in that?
We are engaging in a number of races, local races. We helped get Aaron Peskin elected in the North Beach and Chinatown district. District 3 last November was a very important race. They, being the sort of Donald Trump of San Francisco, this bloated plutocrat, this tech investor named Ron Conway, he's the money behind the throne at City Hall. He threw everything he could into the race against Aaron Peskin, who he knew would be a problem. He's a very progressive guy. He's terrific. It was a hard-fought campaign, but despite being outspent, Aaron won. And that one extra person on the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco has made a world of difference, because we now have a one-vote majority, a progressive majority. And in terms of, you know, fighting evictions and fighting against big tech companies, it's made a huge difference. Now, unfortunately, we have five other races that we have to focus on in November. So it's a district-by-district battle. It's a guerrilla war to take back our own city. And we've sort of picked the people that we're going to throw our support to. We're out there, you know, campaigning with them. We just threw a big party at a bar in the Haight for another candidate from the Haight and the Fillmore, a guy named Dean Preston. He's a tenants' rights lawyer who's been fighting his whole life in Sacramento and San Francisco for renters who've been, you know, thrown out of their homes. So I'm determined to do everything I can. And because, as Bobby Kennedy said at the end of his life, when he was interviewed by a PBS station, he was in the middle of his presidential race, like Bernie right now. He was tired. He never, I think, got over emotionally the death of his brother. He looked 15 years older than he really was. His face was sunburned and kind of ravaged. People clotted him and scratched him because of all these crowds, because they were so desperate to be saved by another Kennedy. You know, we were in the middle of this terrible war in Vietnam that kept dragging on and on. The cities were on fire. The racial tensions were terrible. And so all the hopes of people were being invested in this one poor guy, you know. And so he was interviewed. I always remember this. I saw a film of it later. And the guy said, so why do you keep doing this, what you do? Your brother's been killed. You have so many reasons to give up. He paused a moment and said, well, what other choice do we have? You know? And that's, I guess, the way I feel. You know, at the end of the day, what choice do we have? We have to fight back.
I'm concerned about cheating at the polls, and there's just been so much coming up about that, at least on the internet. You know, this was 15 years ago, or 8 years ago. We were so concerned about our vote and the voting machines reversing who we're voting for, and now we don't even hear about that. I don't understand what happened, why we're not on top of this now.
This is a very important question, and the woman is asking about election fraud and how widespread it is today, and she thinks that the Clinton operation has been guilty of it against Bernie. And even more terrifying, she's based on a comment she heard the writer Greg Palast make recently, who's done a lot of great investigative work on election fraud. He thinks that the fix is in for Trump in November, which is truly terrifying. I don't think at this point that the fix is in quite for Trump. I think the American establishment is so fractured over the Trump question. He is in the process, as you know, today of trying to build now Republican consensus around him, and he was in Washington, which because he's a shrewd, has shrewd rat-like cunning, and he knows that it was time for him to go to Washington to do some fence mending with some of the people who are afraid of him, because he is a loose cannon. And the Republican elites, as we see with, you know, Mitt Romney and all the others running around desperately trying to head him off, there's a lot of powerful sort of elites in the country who are still not there yet with Trump. And Hillary Clinton, look, I mean, Hillary Clinton would deliver all the things that we're talking about for the elite. There will be continued war in the Middle East. There will be continued massive surveillance state. There will be continued Wall Street fraud and looting. And she's not going to really do a whole lot to restrain that. She's going to talk a pretty good game to try and bring Bernie's people into the campaign, get young people to vote and all that. So I don't think they're so frightened of her, the elites. In fact, many elites are with her and think she's their best opportunity. So I wouldn't say at this point Trump is a sure bet. But you know what? Here's what I'm afraid of. Trump is a wild card, and if there is some kind of wild card event, like another terror attack, something like Paris in the United States, then all bets are off. I mean, he's done such a great job of whipping people's fears and hysteria up, particularly around Muslims, that all hell could break loose if there is another major terror attack like that. And, you know, I've done so much research, and I'm sure many of you have too, into the national security state, and it's not out of the question to me that there's an element within the national security state that does want Donald Trump to be elected, and it wants the police state to finally be completed that we're on the way towards, and certainly Donald Trump would consolidate that police state. And then we're talking about a whole different game. You know, I don't like to get too paranoid. I've been on the left my whole life, and the left can tend to get that way, and it's not useful. But this is probably the first time in my life when I've begun to use words like fascism, because that's what it feels like at these rallies. I have reporters there who are telling me what it's like. There's a young reporter I have now writing one of these hot books for me. You know, he's a big, tough guy, but he says it's truly frightening. And what you have is the sense of desperation among working and unemployed people in this country, so exploited for so long, so taken advantage of by the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, that they're desperate enough to put their hopes in a complete charlatan like this billionaire bully, as if he, this guy who's lived his whole life in a billionaire bubble, can understand anything about their lives. I mean, gives a damn about them. I mean, I've heard stories from other reporters about his personal life and what a pig he is. He's a pig to servants, and they are servants to him, who work for him, the gardeners and so on, the women who service him. The guy is a pig, and he would be a pig to the American people, too.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. We're listening to a presentation by David Talbot. He spoke at Sonoma State University in Northern California, March 21st, as part of Social Justice Week. After this musical break, we'll continue with more of the questions and answers and the fascinating discussion that followed Talbot's speech.
And more broadly within the culture, you know, we say that you're entitled to your own opinions, but you're not entitled to your own facts. But with every passing day, it seems to me that as Americans, we live in completely different fact-based world. And what's your comment about that in terms of where that leaves us politically?
The questioner takes note that a lot of the people doing sort of the deeper investigative work on secret government and that kind of thing in America are getting older and may drop dead at some point. I don't know if there's something, you know, I give myself a few more years, but No, I hear you. I mean, you know, Peter Dale Scott, who I revere, who's kind of my mentor, he's in his 80s now. You know him, Chomsky, he's not getting any younger. And Cornel West and a lot of my heroes. I just spent all day with Chris Hedges in Princeton, New Jersey, because one of the books we're going to be doing under my imprint, Hot Books, is a series called Unspeakable, which will be in-depth conversations with people who get marginalized by the media and don't get the attention they deserve. And I think of Chris Hedges as one of those. Chris, fortunately, is in great shape, and he's younger than I am. He's about 10 years younger. But that's one of the reasons I actually started Hot Books, to begin to identify some of these up-and-coming writers, like Alexander Zaychik, who is this writer who's done some really good work on the CIA and is now, as I mentioned earlier, working on this book about the Trump movement. So, yeah, I mean, it's the job of the older editors and journalists like me, before we do kick the bucket, to identify some of these younger people and help them if we can. The last question was, see, I'm old, I forgot. Different, yes. So we talk past each other. Yeah, well, look, I mean, when you've had a media that's consistently dumbed people down, as I was talking about during my speech, not just Fox News. I mean, I look at some of the people I helped train, speaking of younger people, at Salon. And I was very proud of a number of these people, Jake Tapper and others, who was my sort of young up-and-coming political correspondent, Salon, when I was running Salon, and now, of course, is a CNN anchor. You know, I think, yeah, is that really the best for Jake, you know, that he's now CNN anchor and he's asking, you know, a lot of political circus questions. Sometimes you see the old flair that Jake has, and he's a little tougher on people, which is good. But by and large, the American media exists solely for ratings. Les Moonves, the head of CBS, said, Trump may be terrible for the country, but it's not bad for our ratings. That sort of cynicism that's been driving the media for so long now, and the results we're seeing now is an uneducated American public. You know, in some ways, less educated, strangely, as I said, in this digital age when we supposedly are exposed to so many news sources than they were in the old days when Walter Cronkite and a couple other guys told us that's the way it was, you know, at the end of each newscast. I mean, we had three networks telling us that's the way it was, and that was it. But in some ways, the level of discourse, the political debates, that, you know, many people have commented on this. When you look at the old TV debates between Nixon and Kennedy and other presidential campaigns, you go, whoa, they're using big words, you know. I mean, I just could not believe the GOP debates. So I think that's what's going on now, is that none of us are living in fact-based reality, really, unless you're really diligent about seeking out news sources and you make that your job. And that takes time, you know, and it takes the will. While it's easier mostly to just sort of look at the two-headed babies and what Trump said today, you know.
I'm a Vietnam-era veteran. In fact, I had four tours during the war. It seems to me the lies Bush and Cheney told were more egregious than what LBJ and McNamara told my generation. The question is, we had on the edge of impeachment for Clinton for having oral sex in the Oval Office. And yet we had lies about weapons of mass destruction. We had lies about yellowcake uranium from Niger. Lies about the aluminum tubes for centrifuges. And to the best of knowledge, they never even started impeachment proceedings from anyone in Congress. So when the lies for even common people out here in the hinterlands could see these were clearly lies, why there was not even a little bit of political will in Washington to start impeachment proceedings against Bush and Cheney?
Well, that was the theme of my whole talk. So the gentleman asked about the, you know, after Clinton was almost impeached over a consensual sex act, why wasn't George W. Bush, even the hint of impeachment process as a result of the outrageous lies that got us into this war that we're still paying for in any way? Bingo, you put your finger right on it. And, of course, my whole speech tonight was about accountability, or the lack of it, how there is no justice at the top, so there can be no justice anywhere. And when this happens repeatedly, there were some hearings about Vietnam. There were some hearings about the CIA and their excesses after Watergate, the Church Committee. I mean, we had sort of the inkling or the beginnings of that kind of system of accountability in the 70s. But there was a massive sort of backlash against Vietnam. There was a huge anti-war movement. People were appalled by Watergate. And so there was popular will. And frankly, there were people on Capitol Hill, like Senator Frank Church, who had the guts to lead that, facing massive and scary resistance from the CIA. CIA wanted to kill him, literally. And he died rather young. And I'm still not quite sure how that happened. But I think he was in his 50s when he died. So it takes enormous courage for the political system to hold its own people accountable for those crimes. And with the war in Iraq, you had also this major complicity of the American media. I mean, even the great vaunted New York Times, that's supposedly our great public watchdog, and does do a lot of terrific journalism. I mean, they jumped on that bandwagon and rode it all the way. Judith Miller and others, and it wasn't just her, but she was the one who helped invent the whole story about the yellow cake in Niger and the weapons of mass destruction. And
still looking for him.
She was disciplined, but her editors were not. They continued on their careers. So again, there's no accountability in the media world either. And it's not just a mistake. That's such a colossal error that costs so much human life. Those people all should not ever be in front of a TV camera again or have a high-level job. And yet all of them continue. William Kristol, who helped get us into this war, one of the chief neocon, you know, propagandists, he's being quoted every day by the New York Times and this and that about Trump now. He was on Bill Maher the other night. There are certain people who are so disgraced because of what they did in their profession, whether they were in intelligence, in the White House, or whether in the media, that they should never again be allowed to practice their profession. Yet they do.
David Brooks.
Yeah, David Brooks. Many New York Times people. And Washington Post. The Washington Post was also disgraceful in, you know, cheerleading for the war, the run-up to the war. There's never any public reckoning afterwards saying, you know, there was a little, like, oh, whoops, we were wrong about the WMD, and that was it. It was buried inside page 11 in the New York Times.
I think the comment is that it's considered to be un-American to question those decisions. So they've actually twisted it. It's like pretzel logic. The integrity of the wrong decisions is somehow un-American.
They twist it so you're impugning the bravery and the integrity of our troops. You saw this with Vietnam. So, you know, anti-war people, oh, you're spitting on the soldiers. I guess that happened. I was in the anti-war movement during Vietnam. I worked with a lot of veterans. We loved it. Veterans came and worked with us. We welcomed them. So I didn't see that. And I think it's the same today. The people who really honor the troops are the peace movement. And the people who fight for veterans' benefits like Bernie Sanders and not these Tea Party creeps who talk about honoring our troops and never vote for any of the health and welfare votes that come up for troops in Congress.
But just to end up with one quick question. Who's the actor between the CIA, the Manchurian Andy Moody, and Robert Kennedy?
Thank you for that question. He asked about Bobby Kennedy and what I think basically happened there, and was there any parallel between the plot of the Manchurian Candidate, where someone is programmed, you know, hypnotized to kill, and what happened with Bobby? Yes and yes. So here's what I think happened, and I've done a fair amount of research into Bobby Kennedy's murder. He hasn't attracted nearly the kind of investigation that the other assassinations have, like his brother. But here's what happened. I got this from interviewing people who I think, in one case, has important new information to shed on this. I think that as soon as Bobby announced for president, his life was in danger. His family knew this. Jackie and his brother Teddy begged him not to run. They knew, the whole family knew. If you read my earlier book, Brothers, they knew that the people who had killed JFK were still out there. So imagine the bravery of this guy. He had, what, 10 or 11 kids at the time? His family's begging him not to run, but the whole country's in a mess. He knows that he went through a long night of the soul trying to figure out whether he should run or not. He was tortured by the decision. And he went at one point to one of the old journalists in Washington and asked him, whose name I'm forgetting now. And he said, well, if you can live with yourself knowing that Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon will be the next president, then you don't have to run. And, of course, he couldn't live with himself. So Bobby throws himself into these campaign rallies, and there's no Secret Service protection. He has one ex-FBI guy named Bill Berry. He has Rafer Johnson, the former Olympic athlete. He has Rosie Grier, former LA Ram. A couple guys protecting him in huge crowds. They clawed him. They scratch him. He was being stalked, I think, as JFK was. JFK could have been killed in Chicago, we now know. There was a parallel plot there not long before Dallas. He was being stalked in Florida. The CIA was waiting for its moment. So I think that was what they were doing with Bobby, too. They were waiting to see if he'd actually make it. And the California primary was the turning point. because as soon as he won California, his way was pretty well paved to Chicago. And as he said, the Ambassador Hotel, now it's on to Chicago and we'll win there. And he probably would have. Dick Daley, the mayor of Chicago, had called him that night, congratulated him, said, you know, I'm on your team. With Dick Daley sort of talking about controlling things, he looked in pretty good shape. So here's what happened. He comes off the stage. He goes into the pantry. He's being led to a press room to meet with the press. It's a very narrow, dark space, and shots begin to ring out. One of the shooters, obviously, is this young guy, Sirhan Sirhan, but he's in a complete daze. Strangely, John Frankenheimer, the director who made the Manchurian Candidate, I interviewed, and he said he saw Sirhan, and he had this weird flash that this is Manchurian Candidate, which is really eerie. I mean, it's like, talk about life imitating art. John Frankenheimer, he was staying, Bobby, at John Frankenheimer's house in Malibu while he was in L.A. So gunfire erupts. Sirhan Sirhan is, by all witnesses' accounts, about 4 to 5 feet in front of Bobby Kennedy. He's firing wildly, and as soon as he begins to shoot, his arm is grabbed by a number of people, including George Plimpton, the famous writer, and they wrestle him down. They slam his arm down. None of them said, later testified, that there's any way he could have fired the fatal shot. He probably did shoot Paul Schrade, who's a great guy, who's the United Auto Workers activist who was working on Bobby's campaign. Paul got hit in the head that night, and he survived miraculously. But the fatal shot that kills Bobby Kennedy is fired at point-blank range because there's gunpowder burns on the back of the skull from behind his left ear, I believe. It was the left ear. So what I think Sirhan's role was a decoy. He was programmed to basically focus all the attention, begin firing, while a professional killer behind Bobby delivered the fatal shot. There was a security guard who actually did pull his gun. And here's the interesting part. Thane Caesar worked for a security firm, a private security firm. I later found out that a guy named Robert Mayhew, who was the private security guy who the CIA went to do a lot of its domestic dirty work, because under law, the CIA can't operate on U.S. soil. So what they would do, and I'm sure they still do this, they work with local police departments that often have a kind of spy unit within the Metropolitan Police Force in New York or Los Angeles. They also work with private security contractors, and Bob Mayhew was one of those guys. He ran one of the biggest firms, and he was hired by the CIA to recruit the mafia to kill Castro. So we know he was a killer. We know that he was doing assassination. You know, wet work, as they say, for the CIA. Later, he gets himself appointed head of Howard Hughes' operation in Las Vegas. So again, he's working closely with a lot of organized crime people, and now he's situated in Vegas. I was told by somebody who worked in that organization at a high level that he saw Thane Caesar meeting with Mayhew and Mayhew's top security guy shortly before Bobby was killed. It makes sense to me that the hit would have been delivered that night by these private security guys who were hired that night just for that occasion from a firm that was run by Mayhew. I mean, how convenient is this? The CIA assassination contractor runs security firms with guys with guns. And one of them leading Bobby into the pantry, I think quite easily, if it wasn't Caesar, it might have been another. Thane Caesar's gun was never tested by the police. There was lots of weird forensic stuff. Sirhan's gun only held 8 bullets, but there was clear physical evidence that there were more than 8 shots fired that night, and audio evidence as well. The coroner of Los Angeles County, very famous guy, Tom Noguchi, said in his memoir, Sirhan is not the assassin. Based on the forensic evidence, there was no way he could have fired the fatal shot. So that is not a case that's closed. And every time, of course, that Sirhan comes up to be released, there's very powerful forces that don't allow that because they want him to go to his grave as Lee Harvey Oswald, as the John Wilkes Booth that we all think killed Bobby Kennedy. He didn't kill Bobby Kennedy. He was the fall guy, like Lee Harvey Oswald. He was in a deeply hypnotic state when he was arrested and taken into jail. The prosecutors and the homicide cops who interviewed him said he was totally out of it. He didn't know what he'd done. He was, like, on the moon. So that's the way they work.
I mean, new tools or, like, I know there's this Freedom of Information Act now that we can use to kind of shorten this cycle. So that, I know you're laughing. But, yeah, like, are there things that we can do now that may not have existed?
Yeah, so she's asking is, are there new tools or new types of information that we can access now that we may not have been able to a while ago when it comes to things like the Kennedy assassination? You know, that's everyone's hope that there will be some sort of tech solution to it. I mean, and there have been some interesting things, like they found that this cop's motorcycle recorder was left on in Dallas and Dealey Plaza, and so, they recorded the shots. There was a Dicta belt that had the shots recorded. Like I said earlier, Bobby Kennedy, there was a radio reporter who had a tape recorder in the pantry in the hotel the night he was killed, and so they recorded, boom, 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 the number of shots, and they sounded like there were more than eight. So, you know, there could be, although it's pretty late for some of this stuff to come out at this point. Now, what could come out about JFK that is very important are documents that the CIA is still withholding in violation of the law. Because of Oliver Stone's film in 1991, JFK, there was such a big public uproar, Congress was forced to pass something called the JFK Records Collection Act. And every government agency under that law was required to release every document it had that was related in any way to the Kennedy assassination. And I have used thousands of the documents, as have many other writers, to paint, I think, a more accurate portrait of the Kennedy presidency as a government at war with itself. That was an important revelation. So that came out of those documents, and it was quite clear from looking at those documents, Kennedy was at war with the CIA, he was at war with the Pentagon, as he tried to lead America out of the Cold War. There was massive blowback against him because of that. And my new book goes further because I found the diaries kept by Arthur Schlesinger Jr. when he worked for Kennedy at the White House, the famous historian, some of which had been published, but a lot of the diary entries had not been published. And again, inside view of the incredible tension that's building within the Kennedy presidency that explodes in Dallas. Schlesinger, before he died, told me we, meaning the White House, didn't control the CIA, and we didn't control the Pentagon, which is a pretty heavy thing to say in a democracy. But in any case, there's over 1,100 documents, important documents, apparently, that the CIA, in violation of that law, are still holding on to. They keep saying, oh, well, in a few more years, maybe we'll release them. Jefferson Morley, a really great reporter who has a great website called jfkfacts.org, where it covers the Kennedy assassination as if it's an ongoing news story, which it kind of is. He has filed suit against the CIA and Freedom of Information Act to get access to those documents.
We want liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interests.
That's our program for today. Thanks so much for joining us. The Project Censored Show airs on 25 stations around the U.S. For more information and to listen to archives of previous shows, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Anthony Fest is our producer, Erica Bridgman, our engineer. I'm Mickey Huff. We'll see you next time.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks of all the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the ties for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.